All right, my name is Tim Guile, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. A poem of Kabir. Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold to and keep spinning out. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pull back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I'm greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I'm proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds to one thing. Kabir says, listen, my friend, there are very few that find the path. All right, so if you're just joining us, we're finishing up a whole year focusing on the paramis, the six perfections, and this month we're doing a review of the whole set of 10. So finding different ways to kind of put them all together. And I thought tonight I would explore distortions that can come up around the paramis. So the paramis themselves, you know, they're perfections. They're basically this culmination of our practice. They're also something we can train ourselves into. And yet as humans, we can often take something like the paramis and add a little distortion around them. You know, typically around, you know, trying to have a self-image that fits being generous, denying what we really are feeling inside. That's why I read that poem by Kabir, because it points to that when we try to repress something, it just comes out a different direction. Now these 10 paramis, generosity, ethics, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. It's quite a list. And how can we tell if we are causing some distortion around how we're working or practicing with the paramis? How can we start to discern that? We've been talking about that all throughout the year, kind of weaving it in and out, some things to be aware of around these paramis. But if you look at that list, it's interesting what things aren't on that list. You know, particularly we don't see anything about mindfulness. We don't see anything about right view. So if you look at two other big lists in the Dharma is the seven factors of awakening, the Eightfold Path, and also the Four Noble Truths. By the way, next year we're going to be focusing on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path as our teaching theme for the whole year. So those other lists are really important. They have mindfulness, concentration, investigation, wise view, wise intention, wise effort, we don't see represented here in the paramis. So it's not that every list has to be complete. That would be too much. But I think it's also important to realize that those other qualities and cultivations are so important to bring in to our practice with something like the paramis. Because when we start to add them to our practice of working with the paramis, it starts to let us see where we might be distorting them. We might be seeing them in a different way. So mindfulness, of course, is this capacity to meet the moment just how it is. And embedded in that is a quality of deep honesty, a deep acknowledgement of how the moment actually is, how we are actually showing up. You know, I started to meditate. It was a little bit disconcerting how much I would start to see about myself. And like, it was hard to see something that I judged and to see it just as it is without adding more judgment, without using the capacity to see more clearly just to find new ways to judge myself, right? It was like, oh, I'm supposed to be generous. I'm supposed to feel all these other things. I'm supposed to be mindful. I'm supposed to be kind. And these, I could see all the times I wasn't that way with more clarity through the power of mindfulness. You know, concentration in some ways is a more concentrated form of mindfulness, but also has this whole other level of an unwavering quality of seeing. So we can actually penetrate through our delusion, through our ignorance, to see what's underneath, to see things in a more clear way. Investigation is a very powerful part of our practice because it helps us see where are we stuck in something? Where are we holding on? Where are we clinging? Where is there suffering that's not being seen? Where we start to sense it and allows us to go deeper into it. Sometimes I think of investigation as directed mindfulness. It's directed to where freedom lies or where contraction lies, so we can understand it in a deeper way. And wise view is the orientation of what causes suffering, what causes freedom and liberation of the heart. You know, we're understanding that in a deeper and deeper way. And wise intention, wise effort help us to actually engage with those. So all these qualities help us start to safeguard the paramis around our really natural human distortions that can come up. So I'm going to just go through this list of paramis and kind of call out some things that come to mind around how we might distort them. So generosity. So generosity, sometimes we give out of obligation, like I'm supposed to give. It's not really an option. So it's coming from a very different place than an open-hearted releasing or deep open-hearted acknowledgement of someone else's need, you know, like connecting with that other person. Sometimes we give without really considering our own needs. This is an important piece with Donna, with supporting organizations, with supporting teachers, is to reflect on what's my own means. Joseph Goldstein said that, you know, give without regret around Donna. Because if we give too much and we feel like we can't, we're hurting ourselves, we're not able to make our expenses, there's going to be regret around that. If we give too little, we feel that closeness of heart, there'll be that regret also. So finding that fine balance and, you know, the practice of Donna in that context can be a real alive relationship. And all the other ways we practice generosity in ourselves. Maybe we always do these habits of generosity. Maybe it's a rich practice, but maybe sometimes it starts to shift into obligation. Okay, I'm supposed to give at this point, and I'm not really feeling it. Another distortion that come around generosity is giving in a way that's not beneficial. And this is a little bit more subtle because it does bring discernment, brings wisdom in. Because we can give something that doesn't really help that person, doesn't really help them, you know, in their long-term well-being or even their short-term well-being. Anyone who's been a parent, I mean, how often does your child beg for something in the grocery store that they really, you know, like some sugary candies or something like that? How do you kind of hold that line? How do you have that sense of discernment around it? And it's also really realizing that, okay, what really is beneficial to someone? You know, from the deepest dharmic perspective, does it lead to someone's liberation? Does it lead to their suffering to diminish? Which way does it go? So generosity. And all this becomes seen, you know, I can list off everything, but really what matters is you be able to see this for yourself. For me to be able to see for myself how my mind shows up around that. So with the paramis, I like to practice, I hold one like generosity and just notice what that elicits inside. What does it elicit in terms of my body sensations, which is often a very grounding way to approach it, because the body, you know, you can talk yourself into anything, but the body is going to be like, you know, this is contraction, or this body is relaxing, this body is opening. So you sense the quality of internal relationship. You get to know the whole mind state, all the mind thoughts that come up, all the self-beliefs, all the ideas of how you should be and shouldn't be, all the emotionality. All that can be seen through our practices of mindfulness, investigation, steadiness of concentration. So the next parami is of ethics, or sometimes called virtue or morality. I like ethics myself because ethics kind of gives a nuanced quality. You know, it's less of a, you know, should or shouldn't, but more of this really seeing clearly what's causing harm. You know, and also takes all the nuances of power differential and all these other things that's so easy to one action in one context may be very unethical in a different context. Now, there's ways distortions around ethics can come in is when we get too rigid around it. There's a sense of tightness that it always has to be this way. Instead of realizing there can be some play around it, there can be some nuances around how we might apply it. Maybe, for example, telling a lie. You know, I may not always just say absolutely what I think is true in this moment if I feel like it's going to cause harm to someone. Sometimes there is a sense of being kind of self-righteous, like I'm better than other people, and there's this distancing that happens. Sometimes when we have struggle with ethical actions and ethical behavior, take the five precepts, we start to justify why it's okay to do things, why it's okay to cause harm in this situation, or to misuse my sexuality, or perhaps to steal. You know, stealing is one of those ones. I remember I would often justify it to myself. Like I was working for a business, a company, and, you know, worked extra hours without, you know, being paid. I wasn't really asked to work those extra hours, but I just would do it anyway. And so then I would do like little small thefts, like an extra pen or some paper or something like that. And I would justify it in my mind. But as I started to practice, I realized that justification is actually a clue that there's something off. There's something there's not that integrity. And you can notice how the mind's telling these stories and the bodies may be disconnected or a little tense. And if you find something that's actually true, there's a sense of connecting with what's ethical. There's kind of a through line. What I mean by that is things just become more settled. It's like some of the other arenas in my life, I often think about gravity. If gravity is moving through our bodies and I'm kind of all twisted, I go through the whole day like this, I'm going to be pretty sore at the end of the day. But if I can get my bones stacked on each other and gravity goes through the structure, I can really resist that gravity. It actually makes me stronger. So it's similar to when you start to sense that alignment. Sometimes there's a relative, like I'm more ethical when someone's watching versus not watching. that's an interesting one to play with. And sometimes I just notice that, like if no one knew I was going to do this or not do it, you know, that's a nice test of where my ethics are. If no one would ever know, except for myself. You know, so that's how we can start to distort around ethics. I'm much more ethical when everyone's watching and less ethical when I'm by myself. And also there's a sense of the self-image. Now this one also goes to the generosity, the self-image aspect. That we have this idea that I'm a spiritual person, I'm a dharmic practitioner, I want to look like the Buddha or Kuan Yin. And anything that doesn't fit that image, I kind of push it away. I hide it, put it in the closet, distort it, repress it. Okay, but it's not really being honest with myself. I'm trying to present a certain way. And so that's one of these paramis. I mean, the setup is like that if we're not careful. The 10 perfections. This become perfect in all these areas. And if we really took that on, some of those perfections, we're not going to be up to them. Right, there's going to be some lack. So then when that happens, is my self-image more important than the honesty? Right, and when the self-image is more important, that's when we really get into some potentially difficult, dangerous, hurtful territory. And with ethics is one of those. If I'm trying to be like an ethical person, I want to think everyone thinks of me in an ethical way. And yet I'm not willing to notice when I'm not ethical, when I'm not willing to really explore that. You can see this in many helping and healing professions. Therapists, for example, they have this whole tradition of being supervised. So they talk to fellow therapists and talk about those ethical edges when they feel like it's hard to hold this line. Talking, bringing it out, exploring it, airing it out actually helps them become much more ethical. But if their self-image is so strong, I'm not going to show that, that spot. It's going to just build up to a point where they actually cross that line with the client. It's the same thing with spiritual teachers. Okay, I'm supposed to be a spiritual person, so I hold all these other things at bay. But if I'm not willing to own them, not willing to acknowledge them, to share them with my peers, with people, with my mentors, then there's going to be issues that come up. And you can sometimes see that in our own practice. And this is where the safeguards of mindfulness comes up. It's going to be really hard to ignore that if we have that deep honesty with our practice. And yet there's this power of delusion that can come in, can allow us to see, not see that. So ethics, generosity. So the next one, next parami, is of renunciation. Okay, renunciation. So renunciation, sometimes we can get really tight around it, or a sense of contraction around it. Or sometimes we read about someone's renunciation, and we think, okay, I need to be like that. I need to force myself into that kind of letting go. Let go of anything that's a sense pleasure, anything that I enjoy, anything that's pleasurable, right? That's how we can sometimes take it. But it's really, there's nothing wrong with any of those experiences, except when we start to cling to that. So we start to hold it too low, too tightly. We enjoy it while it's here. When it ends, we just gracefully let it go. But if we try to force it, it's that same pattern of repression that starts to come. This is like trying to do the idea or concept or philosophy of renunciation instead of the actual heartfeltness of it. I think renunciation at its, one of the beautiful aspects is when we let go of something because we see that it causes suffering. It causes harm. In some ways it almost lets go of us. It's a beautiful expression of it. So same thing of self-image. I'm trying to hold that image of being a spiritual person who's renouncing, like this poem by Kabir. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but one day I noticed the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still throw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pull back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I am greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I am proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds to one thing. So renunciation at the deepest level is that renunciation of that root of what causes suffering. And that one link is always there, because so often we don't establish or we don't see the underlying cause of all that. I didn't say that very clearly, but basically when that sense of self is unseen, unexamined, still believed in, we're going to just try to be a more polished sense of self. And it's going to shoot out different directions. I'm going to be trying to be proud of myself. I'm going to try to be more humble. I'm going to wear finely clothed, cloth. And I'm going to switch to burlap. But just switches direction. It switches until we finally see that sense of self as inherently just another phenomenon that's arising and passing away. So for renunciation, moving to energy. Now energy is this force that allows us to really practice, to bring spirit into the world, into our lives, into our spiritual growth and understanding. Some of the distortions come around it is when we're not applying it really in a clear way. We're not clear about which way we're going, right? If you're ever, sometimes in my family, when we get ready to go like to holiday party or to family or something, there's often a lot of kind of busyness that's not very much, a lot of energy, but not really directed to actually leaving. It's like, okay, we got to clean the whole house before we leave. So we come back to a clean house. It's nice to come back to a clean house, but, like if it's 1 a.m. and you got to catch a 5 a.m. flight, maybe, okay, it's okay, the dishes are a little dirty or something like that. But sometimes we put that energy in the wrong direction. It's not really direct. It's not informed by wisdom. Sometimes the energy has a sense of self-serving. And this goes back again to that sense of self. And this is how we all start to practice. We have this assumption of self, and the practice starts to kind of pick away at it. It starts to show us there's a little gaps in it. And it tends to be a lot of what informs our practice. I mean, when I started to practice, I wanted to be a better meditator. You know, I wanted to really, you know, work hard at being quiet and still and connected. But that sense of me who wanted to do that was embedded in it. And it brought lots of energy. Think about your life when you've become really passionate about something, whether it's a hobby or a skill or a profession, something that you put a lot of energy into, learning how to ski or whatever it might be, playing an instrument. You know, for myself, when I did all those exercises, all those activities, I could bring a lot of energy into learning and growing with it. But after the Dharma practice started to change me, I started to realize that a lot of those were really driven by me trying to have a different self-image, to become a different person. And once I started to see that person wasn't so solid, the energy started to fall away. I couldn't motivate myself in the same way. The energy didn't come out in the same way. And sometimes this is a hard part of our practice. We start to feel a little bit aimless, a little disillusioned, because one strategy that's got us through school, through work, through struggles, through all these things, kind of the root of it doesn't make sense anymore. It doesn't make sense in the same way. It's like, okay, because often I would think, if I got this skill or this accolade or this whatever it might be, then finally I would be happy. Finally then I would be satisfied. But I realized that wasn't true. I would just have the next thing. You know, so what happens is our energy starts to transform from that kind of, say, ego-driven or that self-driven to a different form. The good news is that is just a transition that once we start to see that, there's a different thing that flows through us, a different source of this energy. Another distortion around energy can be that urgency that, you know, I really want to get over this pattern. And have you ever noticed a pattern that you just see more clearly and like, okay, I see it now. How can I get rid of this? I mean, I spent a lot of my time talking to students about how can I get through this pattern as quickly as I can. And as I work with students over the years, there's this often this initial like, okay, this is intolerable. I have so much energy to get rid of this. Tell me what I need to do about it. But after a few years, that pattern still arises, but it doesn't have any grip or very little grip. They have a very different relationship to it. And often it's not because of something they forced to happen, but more their wisdom just started to grow. You could actually say they grew out of it, actually released from them. It's a very different way the energy arises. So with energy, we move now to patience. So patience. So as we talked about last week and during the month itself, patience can be a counterbalancer to energy. Right? When our energy gets a little too brittle, a little too frenetic, a little bit too will-driven, patience comes in to say, okay, let's just allow things to be how they are. Let's allow things to unfold how they are. But some of the distortions can happen when we kind of adopt that as a kind of a passivity. I'm going to just kind of wait and just see what's going to happen. There's a joke that it's a little religious from Christianity, so hopefully it's not offensive talking about it in a Dharma hall. But there's a man who was in a flood zone. You know, floods, water was coming, and they got in their house. And someone came by, actually before the floods got there, someone came with a truck saying, come on, let's get you out of here. He says, no, I trust in God to come take care of me. So the flood started to come up, and he had to get up on the roof, and then a boat came by. It's like, hey, let's rescue. And he said, no, God's going to take care of me. And finally, a helicopter came and dropped a line. He said, no, God's going to take care of me. And finally, the flood came, and he died. And he went up to, what is it, Pearly Gates, wherever that is. I wasn't raised Christian, so.
You're doing a good job.
Doing okay so far? So who greets it? It's St. Paul, St. John, St. Peter. Okay, St. Peter says, God says, okay, and welcome, but why didn't you get some help? He's like, well, the man was really mad because I waited and waited for you. He said, well, I sent you a truck, and then I sent you a boat, and then a helicopter. And so sometimes that's how patience shows up, is that we're waiting and waiting for the right thing to hit us over the head. And so sometimes we don't recognize the right timing of something. When's the right timing to act, to actually engage in our life? Yeah, so patience can sometimes have that distortion of passivity. These last two, energy and patience, I think it's really helpful to know your own temperament. What's your style? You know, do you tend to be more of a, okay, I'm going to just wait and wait for things to happen? Or I'm going to be like, oh, we got to do. Whatever your temperament is, you're going to learn a lot by doing opposite of that. Because one thing, it helps you have a different repertoire, a more full expression of yourself. Another way is it starts to break up that sense of self, which gets established in the always doing or the always kind of passive. Right? And that's really a big part of practice, is learning to be looser around this sense of self, to allow us to step into it when it's helpful and needed, and to release it when it's not, to go have this fluidity with it. So sometimes there's the fear of action, of, you know, doing the right thing or doing the wrong thing. Like if we have trouble with just making decisions. And going back to our mindfulness practice, patience has this sense of the timeless. So there's nothing needs to happen or change. Well, something that's kind of looks like patience, but maybe is more paralysis, like you're just afraid of making a choice or a decision, it feels very differently interiorly, inwardly, that's the right word, inwardly. And when you notice that, okay, there's that lack of energy, that lack of engagement, mindfulness brings this quality of holding, observing, sensing, investigation allows us to start to see maybe the deeper self-beliefs, the way that we form a sense of myself around it, all the actions that flow from that. So from from patience, we move to truthfulness. So truthfulness, in the Parami expression of it, is one of the most beautiful aspects, because we're living a sense of alignment, of integrity. We're really connected to what's true. Well, the distortion around it is when we start to mistake our beliefs, our opinions, our limited perspective as being absolutely true. And we argue about it. Or we judge someone for not having the same one. Or we try to convince someone to adopt our perspective, our sense of truth. Another way to say it is we take ownership of it. So there's an ownership which is a sense of self-responsibility, ownership which is healthy. But from this context, this is the ownership is saying something is mine when it's not really mine. It's like if we looked at the moon, and I was driving in and I could see the moon just past full with the clouds just kind of obscuring it. But there's this beautiful quality to it. Right? And that was the same quality. Anyone who looked up to the sky would see that moon. You know, the moon, whatever country, whatever state, wherever you might be, you could see the moon arising. But I couldn't say, that's my moon. That's not your moon. This is my own personal moon. That's like taking something that's in this level of truthfulness, something that's universal, and claiming it as mine. Okay, that's a big distortion, right? It's a contraction of that. So generosity is that freeness, that loosening up around it, that sense of opening around that truthfulness. Truthfulness also, I mean, there's ways, different ways we can interpret and talk about this one. But for myself, truthfulness often comes from this deep seeing and this deep knowing and understanding that actually starts to transcend words, concepts, and ideas. Like that Rumi poem, you know, I mean, there's a field out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing. In that field, I'll meet you there. In that field, words can't hold that. It can't go there. It's beyond that. It's too rich. It's too vast. Right? And sometimes we take something like that and we try to describe it, or you write a book about it or whatever it might be, and it becomes a little bit more rigid, becomes less fluid. Another way you could say it is that truth is something that's arising moment by moment. And we either can access it and open to it, or it's not, we're disconnected or distracted or whatever it might be. But once that truth's arising, the next moment has this next truth, right? So it's a process of flow. It's like Heraclitus saying, you can't step in the same river twice because it's not the same river and you're not the same person. Right? But I'm the same person, I'm the same river. Having that flow of the truth. All right, so resolve, the next one. So resolve is one that I think it's pretty easy to have some distortions around, related to energy, that I might have this deep resolve or commitment to obtain something, to get somewhere, to do something, and yet we're not really have resolve around the right thing, or we don't understand it. Spiritual practice, right? So especially when this tradition first came to the West, there was a tendency for some, this is a little stereotypical, but often kind of young men who had a lot of striving energy, who wanted to be fully awakened. They liked that idea. Right, so there's a lot of deep commitment and striving for it, a lot of resolve, but there wasn't tempered with being realistic, wasn't tempered with patience, wasn't tempered with wisdom. And so they were actually practiced so hard that they would cause damage to themselves, whether it's physical, or sometimes they would lose mental balance, you know, sometimes even go psychotic. This sometimes happens. And you know, as the teaching community start to realize this and recognize it, the instructions start to change to kind of take the legs out from that striving, right? Because you could say, okay, everyone, we're going to sit here until we're all awakened, all right? I don't care what you got cooking at home, or, you know, I don't care about Christmas. We're going to just stay here, all right? Let's just do it, you know, and then we would strain, and then we would eventually collapse and give up, and maybe, you know, one in a million might get awakened from that energy if they're really ripe for it. But we've learned that the striving needs to really be balanced and tempered by a sense of allowing the moment to be how it is. Because resolve can have that, okay, I'm not going to move at all. In the Buddha's night of awakening, I'm going to sit here no matter what. But he was really ripe for that. And so this is a tricky one. To notice how much ego can you bring in, how much sense of, sometimes there's a sense of trying to get over yourself. For myself, sometimes there's an expression of self-hatred, really. How I am right now is not okay. I need to get over myself by becoming enlightened or awakened or whatever it might be. I'm going to just push through that. Okay, and that didn't work. You know, there's a much gentler approach that is very, very helpful for myself. So often that sense of wanting to become. Okay, so wanting to become, there's an aspiration, there's a sense of yearning, which is so powerful and helpful in our practice. But you just kind of hold that. You notice, am I trying to become a better me? And some of that's really helpful. I mean, it's much better for yourself and everyone around you if you're a little bit more kind, a little bit more mindful, a little bit more patient. You know, those are all very helpful. That's if you're less stressed. And on a deeper level of Dharma, we're looking at that, really dissolving that sense of self. It's in itself. Okay, the final parami of loving kindness. Actually, there's two more, sorry. Loving kindness and equanimity. So loving kindness, one of the distortions comes around, again, it's back to this self-image that I want to be this nice, kind person, right? And what happens when I'm not nice and kind? What happens to that energy? What happens to those thoughts and those actions? You know, do they just kind of get suppressed, or do they come out sideways, or do you just explode? Like when we did the simile, the psalm a few months ago or a month ago, I talked about that. That's the simile where this woman is pretending to be really kind and nice, but her servant basically keeps breaking the rules and pushing her till finally she loses it and hits her over the head with a rolling pin. And shows that this woman's not as nice as she appears, basically. So the Buddha was pointing to, you can't fake this. You can't pretend to do this, right? So it actually starts to come from a different place. So loving kindness, that's why I like to define it not so much as being loving and kind, but more that willingness to turn toward experience, which is an expression of being kind and loving. But if you say, okay, I have to be kind and loving, how many of us have had trouble with loving kindness because you just don't feel that loving energy? You don't feel that kind of emotive quality and you get discouraged. But if you reframe it as this willingness to turn toward and be next to, be in relationship. There's that movie, what is it called? It's a dance movie. It's a kind of a funny one, but there's this woman of this dance studio, and she would always put on this really, you know, she'd be struggling. They put on this really happy face to go out to be with the students. You know, that putting on that happy expression. So is there a repression, or is there denial of some of the things which aren't loving kindness? If you really want to practice it, can you have loving kindness toward those qualities in yourself? Can you have loving kindness to those parts of yourself which you hold outside, that you judge, that wish weren't there? So the final one is equanimity. So equanimity is also very common to have distortions around, because we read about it, we teachers talk about it, and we try to adopt that equanimity. And what happens is the people around us start to feel us as being kind of cool, aloof, distant. We kind of talk down to them like, oh, it's all empty, you know, it's, you know, kind of you feeling, you kind of, what you do is you use equanimity as you using the idea of equanimity to become more distant, become more in your head. You have this philosophy, you're basically trying to filter everything through. There's not this connection with life. It's this definition I've shared, is that equanimity is being equally near all things. So if you're feeling that sense of equanimity, just check in with the heart. Is the heart open? Is the heart connected? Can I be connected to this painful experience, this joyous experience, with a quality of balance? That's moving toward true equanimity. But if I can't really feel my heart because I've closed it off, I've locked it down, I've gone into my mind and my idea, there's this sense of being equally distant to all things, and that's a distortion that comes in. So these 10 paramis, they're beautiful qualities. And we also have to bring our other tools of mindfulness, of investigation, of wise view, of understanding what causes suffering to bear. It helps us know ourselves, helps us be more honest and sensitive, to recognize thought, our ideas versus our direct experience. This helps us direct our practice toward liberation. And that's what these paramis are designed to do. So I hope this is helpful and beneficial, and just to help bring this quality of really discernment and wisdom as we practice the paramis. All right, let's just sit quietly for a moment or two, and I'll talk about the homework for this week. All right, thank you for your kind attention. So we'll talk about the homework, and then next week we'll have a discussion. So I'll do a shorter recap of this talk, and then have a chance for you to dialogue with each other, talk about how these show up in your own practice. Such a rich part of being in a Sangha is being able to articulate your practice and to hear other people's exploration. So pick one of the paramis to explore this week, this last couple weeks. So I listed them all out for you. Can you see any distortions that arise from trying to adopt this parami, such as projecting a false self-image? Right? So just hold that parami and notice if it's this kind of open, flowing quality, this quality that's leading on, or is there a sense of like rigidity around it, like I have to show up a certain way? How do mindfulness, investigation, and wise view support seeing and understanding? All right. So I look forward to hearing how that goes. And now we have a chance for any questions or sharing you might have. So if you're here in the room, you could raise your hand and we can, Cheryl can bring the mic over. And online, you can just raise your virtual hand. Yes, go ahead, Austin.
Thank you, Tim, for a beautiful talk. At a recent meditation retreat at Spirit Rock, I was sitting and had a experience just sitting with not self for a while, and I went back to my room and it didn't go away, and I started freaking out a little bit. I'm like, oh man, because what was my normal self is like, oh, what do I have to do tomorrow? You know, I have to do this, the future. And when that was gone, it was scary. So I asked Tweri and other people about it and listened to some talks from Ajahn Sumedho after the retreat, because everything's clearly. But what I took away from that experience was, especially from Ajahn Sumedho, is this language of absolute and conventional reality. Mm. And conventional reality being, I'm a husband, you know, I'm a dog owner, I have a social security number, I have to go to work, you know, the things that we associate with the ego. And those things aren't bad. I think sometimes when we're practicing when I'm practicing the paramis, there's almost like sometimes a sense or a misunderstanding of those things as being bad. Mm-hmm. Because you taste or touch this ultimate reality where it is kind of not self. And so I just thought that was helpful to create a permission structure to hold both, mm-hmm. in our day-to-day experience. And I was curious if you could talk a little bit about that in relationship to the downsides of the paramis. Thank you.
Sure. So yeah, like an experience of non-self or feeling that self, you know, fall away, like the way you described it, can sometimes feel just really, you know, beautiful and special and unique. And then at some point, there's kind of a deeper falling into it, and you realize, because sometimes we can observe the non-self, or it's really what's happening is we're noticing the self getting really, really quiet, being really, you know. But there's still, if we really look carefully, there's still this orientation of me observing this experience. But then when you go back to your room, something deeper fell away, and the actions of the sense of self, it's like there's like every day I pick up this, and then suddenly like that's I can't there's not there to pick it up anymore. And it's like, wait a second, and there's this disorientation. It can be disconcerting because it's like, basically, our whole life is based upon this premise of a continuous, non-changing sense of self. And when it falls away, it can be a little freaky for a while till we kind of recalibrate it. And I think that what Ajahn Sumedho talked about, and I've heard Christina Felden talk about it in this way, that there's a navigational self that knows how to walk the dog and be a husband and do your work and drive here and there. And that's really functional. That's the conventional sense of self versus the absolute sense of self is much faster. And the difference is that the sense of self really likes projects like the paramis. Okay, great. I got 10 things to try to work on. That's great. Oh, it takes multiple lifetimes. That's even better. So I can, you know, I can get really discouraged about them. I can be really excited by them. But that sense of self is all in the background doing it. And it's like the movie The Matrix when he took the pill and boom, he gets unplugged. And this whole reality changes. Except it's not so dark and grimy and bleak like it is in The Matrix. But anyway, there's that shift of perception, that really profound shift. They realize everything you're based upon, your life doesn't make sense anymore. Right? And then there's a process of making it make sense again. You come back into the conventional self or the navigational self and you fully inhabit it, but you don't believe in it fully.
Right.
It's a, yeah. There's a little bit of a crack. There's a little bit of a space. And that starts to broaden. And then that is part of the navigation. It's like there's integration of insight, of deep seeing in our practice. We see it and it freaks us out. And then maybe we forget. And then eventually we get a deeper seeing. And then we learn how to start to integrate it. So it doesn't have to be a conflict. So all the things about the distortions, basically, to go back to your question, all the distortions have to do with that sense of self not being fully seen through. If that sense of self is operating, there's going to probably be some little distortions. Not to say that we can make the conventional sense of self much happier, much more functional, much more engaged. It actually, ideally, the very action of working with these paramis starts to loosen and thin that sense of self. Like generosity. It's like, you know, hey, everyone, look how generous I am. Versus, you know, you just give in a very quiet way, but you're very connected. That starts to really loosen the sense of self. Yeah, so it's really kind of which is leading. Is it thickening, strengthening that sense of self, starting to loosen the sense of self? And then, you know, when we start to have a deeper realization of non-self, then the paramis start to be the natural way that we flow in life. Right? Thank you, Austin. All right, there's a big question. Thanks for starting us off. Anyone else have anything like to ask or share? Yeah, David?
So with the paramis, I see these two opposite perspectives. I'm trying to balance them. The one perspective is, you know, cultivate the paramis deliberately. So look for ways to cultivate each one.
Yeah.
And then the opposite perspective could be focus on the breath, focus on the body. And the words of Narayan, she said once, just let the silence do its work. That was during a retreat. I thought that was a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So how much can we just do simple practice and rely on the paramis to arise on their own? And how much do we need to deliberately make them happen? I'm afraid the answer is discernment.
Yeah, so it's a beautiful question around that, you know, that action of how engaged do we get with our practice or versus how, you know, how much. And if you look at our, basically, as we go through the different ups and downs of our practice, sometimes we need one versus the other. You know, there's a beautiful time for being just simply abiding with the moment and letting the stillness do its work. And there's times when we really want to cultivate these paramis and really bring them to the forefront and practice with them. And you can almost see what helps your practice stay alive and engaged, right? Because if we said, okay, Dave, I want you to never do any of the paramis, just sit in silence, right? Sometimes if I check back in, you'd be like, this is like not much happening here. This is just kind of boring, or I feel discouraged. I don't feel like I know how to integrate with my life. So then, you know, the paramis, okay, add a little paramis. Or if I said, you know, just practice, Cheryl, you just do the paramis, never sit. You know, you'll be practicing, but, you know, it won't have the grounding of meditation. So it's like we kind of switch it up. Basically, we kind of have a, what I'm trying to say is we have this sense of when am I really engaging with my practice and what's really alive for me. And any part of the Dharma, for most of us, we can't just be sustained. I'm going to just focus on dukkha for the rest of my life. You know, it's like we kind of mix that up a little bit. Just like if you're, you know, you're anything you do, a different skill, you do a different skill for a while, come back, then that new old skill is a little bit more informed. Maybe you've grown with that. The other one is actually helps enhance things. Yeah. If as long as we're not getting too, you know, distracted, like, okay, I got a, you know, 20-step plan that, you know, on Tuesdays it's generosity, Wednesdays it's renunciation because I got to balance those. And, you know, just try to keep it as simple as possible. Is it what Einstein said? Everything should be as simple as possible, but not more than that. You know, so how we can make it as simple? Let's just kind of feel where your heart's drawn, right? And the final thing I'll say about that, because we've talked about this just kind of in isolation, but listen to the feedback of life. Right, so the feedback in terms of how do people, you know, how are your relationships? How's the relationship with your wife? How's it with your coworkers, with your clients, with your teachers, you know, your fellow practitioners? Start to listen, and some, they might not come out and tell you, but you can start to notice how they are around you, right? And if you find like, okay, there's kind of a distance growing, you know, bring that forth. Bring one of the paramis forth, perhaps. Or if you're over-practicing the paramis, maybe bring that stillness forth. So use basically life's kind of feedback of dukkha and suffering and struggle as a clue, okay, maybe the practice needs to shift a little bit. Maybe toward the stillness, maybe toward the cultivation. Does that help at all? I kind of.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. When we talk about meditation, the Pali is bhavana, which means cultivation. So sometimes you're more actively cultivating and sometimes more passively. All right, what else is out there? Anyone online? All right, over here.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if you could possibly, this could be a bit vague maybe, but if you could speak more, a little bit more about patience in terms of waiting for like the right moment or the right thing or the right sign.
Mm.
'Cause I did enjoy your tale about the guy waiting on the
yeah.
roof with the flood. But I was wondering if there's like the opposite of that, like where you think you think you're patient and then you see something, but it wasn't the right thing, if that makes sense.
Say that again a little differently, the last bit.
Well, I guess I want to cultivate more patience because maybe I think I've been patient, but I actually was rather impatient.
How can you tell?
Well, if you... Sorry.
I'm putting it in the spot, but
yeah,
this is part of my answer is like, yeah,
sure.
To see what...
I don't have any specific examples, I suppose, but maybe you think you've saved enough money for something, or maybe, and you really haven't, maybe like a thing that you wanted for yourself, or another example would be like maybe you... I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank.
No, you're fine. Yeah, that's fine. The reason I say that is one way to work with it is to make it a learning of when you're not patient. You know, Joseph Goldstein, I think, said that she, you know, when he was a kid, he had some kind of science kit that had carrots that would grow. But he would keep pulling them up to see if they're grown instead of just letting them grow. And so instead of saying, oh, I'm not patient, it's like, oh, let me kind of explore that. Let me notice what it feels like. So for myself, when I think I'm being patient and the thing I've been kind of patiently with changes and I'm like, feel a sense of relief, then I know, okay, I was more white knuckling it. I was enduring it versus being really patient, right? So instead of using that, again, mindfulness is kind of a double-edged sword that we can use that clearer seeing to find new ways to judge ourselves. It's like, oh, I was impatient again. It's like, oh, what's it like to not be patient? You know, how does that load up around any situation? So there's so many different ways that can show up. So first of all, just kind of make it a sense of learning to notice, okay, what is it? And what I mean by that is kind of this full-hearted inventory of whatever is arising, noticing the mind, the heart, the sense of body contraction, and all those are kind of, that's the baseline, but there's also how the view of the world changes based upon that. So all, you know, the way our sense of self, one of the insidious things it does is it basically orders the world to fit its belief. It orders the world to believe, we interpret life based on our past history is another way to say that. Part of that dependent origination is technical way of talking about selfing, creating this sense of self. That's an integral part, a big chunk of those 12 steps. But starting to actually see that, wow, this is how I view life when I'm impatient, or I'm trying to be patient, or I'm pretending to be patient. And at the same time, also start to notice when you are patient, you know, when there is like a true patience, when it's like, yeah, I can just be here as long as is needed. And maybe that may be only 5 minutes that you can be like that. And that's okay. You have a taste of that. It's like, oh, that's what it's like, that sense of letting things unfold the way they just naturally do. And in terms of action, it's also kind of trial and error, basically. And the more aware and present we are, conscious we are, the more we can learn from that trial and error. And sometimes it surprises you, like, wow, this, you know, I just stepped in at the right time. Other times it's like, probably would have been better to wait a day or so. And you just kind of learn that. Yeah, so it's, and then finally I'll just say that practice patience, you know, in the easy ways that you can. Like maybe just sitting with your breath. You know, can I be patient? Maybe make that a theme that, okay, every sit, I'm going to bring patience to whatever's arising. And patience might look like just, okay, I'm going to sit with this urge to itch my ear for 5 seconds. Right? So there's maybe a little of enduring with that, a little bit of willpower, but you're trying to work with that quality of patience. And by doing that, you'll probably surprise yourself that you're with someone that you usually aren't very patient with, and suddenly there's a different way of relating to them. Maybe there's a sense of grace or of you giving yourself more permission to just be yourself. That's another way to say it. Allow yourself to be just how you are. This is one of those things, hopefully help a little bit.
Yeah, it did. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that question. Cheryl.
Yeah, this idea of patience. Patience with renunciation and loving kindness. Talk about how patience and renunciation work together. I'm just thinking about when I'm driving. That's when I'm the most impatient, probably, and on a regular basis. And it's because I'm not renunciating my need to get somewhere faster than I think I need. You know. You know what I mean? I'm not renunciating something. And then I'm not, and then what you said about feeling like I failed on a parami and not giving myself loving kindness about it. So it's like this overall, kind of how they all work together.
Mm-hmm, yeah. 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 Like that cluster, those three. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that, like, let's take the driving example. It's like, as I'm driving, I'm feeling impatient because this car is going way too slow. It's like 60 and they're going, 45 here. So I can feel that impatience and then, okay, I'm supposed to be renouncing that. And then, but that doesn't, it doesn't really help because I'm still, but if I, what's helpful, that's where loving kindness comes in. If we define it as heartfelt acknowledgement, how the moment actually is, what's actually here, and realize that we usually have these kind of tears. There's the initial impatience. And there's the deeper ones underneath that. And I start to just open to all of that. It's like, sometimes I just ask, okay, how do I want the moment to be different than it is? You know, where exactly is my rub with this moment? And sometimes it's like, okay, I'm going to be, I got to get to Seattle Insight and give a talk. You know, they don't realize I have to give the talk. And by doing that, okay, I'm acknowledging, okay, maybe I'm afraid of showing up late or getting in trouble or whatever it might be. And so that starts to open it up. And sometimes, you know, loving kindness, compassion to that person, maybe they're confused or not sure where to go. Is it their, because I'm running late, is it their fault? You know?
Yeah. Because you left the house late. Right?
Yeah, it's like we blame the world for getting in our way. It's like they're just kind of going at their own pace, their own. So sometimes that helps by acknowledging your own self deeply, you start to come into compassion for that person, or, you know, relative to loving kindness. And then renunciation, what you've been trying to renounce, it actually starts to let go of you.
Yeah. Yeah. And even when you say, you know, they're just going on their way, how lovely for them to just be so patient and, you know, just to be going 15 yeah. miles an hour. Who cares? So. Yeah. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah. Okay. And so, yeah, sometimes if a person has a particular, I can distinguish there's something about them that maybe suggests why they're driving that slow. Okay, once if I was them, that was me. You know, once if I couldn't see at night or I was, you know, confused, you know, how would I be? Yeah, so there's different ways you can play with it. But yeah, the renunciation, trying to leave with that sometimes backfires. But I think going with a sense of compassion, of kindness, acknowledging what's here, then renunciation actually just happens. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, nice way to, I like how that's you engaging with those three. We can pick a lot of threes and see how they kind of work together. All right, anyone else? Everyone online is enlightened and happy, and all the perfections are fully manifested. No distortions at all.
In one easy lesson.
We just get this done. All right. Anyone else have anything they'd like to ask or share? That's one of the advantages of being meditators. We're used to sitting silently. Doesn't have to be awkward. I know I like to pause. I probably pause longer than I should, but I know as an introverted person, it would often take me a while to get the courage to say something. It's like, and then finally I would do it, but if I had enough space or enough impetus, but also maybe that's enough. Maybe that's enough for everyone. All right. So let's practice this week with these paramis, a couple more weeks of them, and then you can never think about them again if you want. Or it could be a lifetime companion. You know, play with the distortions, you know, just not, it's not a chance to judge yourself, but just to see, understand yourself more fully, more completely. Just be curious. Have a sense of play around it. Oh, this is interesting how I kind of shift this generosity a little bit. I notice how mindfulness. Yeah, go ahead, Leslie. All right, Leslie's got.
So the idea is that with the investigation of the paramis and your responses is that you're loosening the attachment to self, because all the references are, this is what you're doing and your self is looking like this, or you're doing that. So the idea is that you're not as solid as you think you are when you're looking at these things.
Well, this goes back a little bit to Dave's, you know, question of just letting the stillness work. You can also kind of let the paramis work. That a lot of practices that we do, we start really with, okay, I'm really doing them. my sense of self, my conventional sense of self, navigational self is fully engaged. I'm really working on this. And there's a lot of those practices, it's really beautiful that they, by design, they start to loosen the sense of self without you even realizing that. It's actually the mindfulness practice when we say, you know, just open to what's arising, allow it to be how it is, have a steadiness of attention. That's actually loosening the sense of self. It's actually designed to do that, but we don't tell that. It's like, dissolve the sense of self. You know, it's like we don't tell you that's what we're doing, but we're instructing you how to start to loosen it, how to start to practice it. So same with the paramis. Yeah, so it's fine to, I'm going to really engage with these. I'm going to go through all of the distortions around it, and that's okay. And then it's going to start to, it's going to start to work its way out. Yeah. Yeah, so that's another way we could say, just don't worry about it. Just... It's better to practice than not practice. All right. Anyone last questions before we call it a night? Yes, okay. Everyone's, we got one.
Thank you. Okay, this is like my issue with loving kindness. I feel like we're going to go back to the driving. And I can't help but feel like your example sounded passive. And so where is that like compassion? Yes, they might be like, they might not be able to see versus like, I do have a place to go. Like maybe they shouldn't be on the road.
Yeah.
You know, like I have a destination. So where's that line?
Yeah. So where's the line with, can everyone hear her online? Yeah. Yeah, so that's this line between loving kindness and okay, I'm trying to lead with that quality versus sometimes action really needs to be happen. You know, that's that where that passivity can come in through patience. So kind of I think a helpful thing to reflect on is just to know your own pattern. Like every time you drive, it's like okay, there's always this discernment. I got these people shouldn't be. You probably have more to learn by practicing loving kindness versus vice versa, right? It's part of what I said before that our internal logic is trying to reinforce our own belief systems. You know, our sense of self is part of it's just sort of more core belief system. So it's part of that. But yeah, so it's a lot of times you just, okay, I'm going to go this other way. I'm going to make this sense of discernment around it. And it feels differently internally, I guess, is one way to say it. Because we can do the same exact action. Okay, I'm going to drive around this person. I'm going to look to see, okay, maybe they're having trouble and they, you know, roll up the window. Hey, you need to go get a cognitive test or something. You know, sometimes that same exact action can come from very different places, right? It can come from a place of connection and concern. It can come from a place of aversion that's really buried down. I'm trying to pretend I'm nice. It can come from a lot of different ways. So basically, know yourself, play with it, play with both sides. And you can listen to, as you're doing it, the feedback internally. It's like, okay. And sometimes it's like, okay, I need to get here. I need to get to where I'm going. And I'm going to do what I need to do that. Yeah, so it's like when we lose that repertoire, that flexibility, that's when our practice is getting too rigid. That's one of the distortions that come in. I can only be a loving kindness driver. I can't be an assertive driver or a defensive driver or aggressive driver, whatever that might be. Then I'm too rigid in my practice. Does that get to you, help you a little bit or no? Not quite? Yeah, it's not quite.
No, I don't say that. Oops,
sorry.
You're good. Yeah, yeah. It's a really important aspect of, and this is the edge of our practice. When do I act? When I don't act? You know, what motivates that? All right. Any last questions? All right. Okay. Look forward to talking to you next week, exploring and what you've discovered with your own practice. You know, loving kindness. Pull that one up. That's a good one. Driving and loving kindness. There you got a suggested homework there. All right. So have a good evening, and thank you all the volunteers, both online and in person, who helped make this happen. All right, goodbye everyone online. Be well.